Lovely. Really appreciating the chance to also sit together beforehand. And I'm here in the Bay Area, and I was hearing a light little bit of rain outside, which was quite calming and encouraging. Now that the rains are coming. And I think the Sangha is always important. It's always struck me that it's one of the three of the triple treasures up there with Buddha and Dharma, there's Sangha. And maybe even more poignantly important now that many of us can feel quite isolated in the times that we're in. And, we all know that the world as we know it has been upturned in various ways. And we've been in this pandemic situation, it's now almost a year. And it's not quite clear, what's happening. Is it another few months? Is it another year? Is it longer than that? And there's a lot of unknown. We have a certain resilience, but there's continuing to be unknown. And how do we work with that? And what will the world look like, when this is done? And I've appreciated people who've written and thought about the fact that a way of looking at all of this as there are cycles, there's cycles of light and cycles of dark and cycles of birth and death and rebirth. And one way to explore this is to perhaps allow that we've been in a dark side of the cycle. That maybe this has been a time, maybe still is a time, to allow ourselves to go fallow, not necessarily a time of growth. And to get to know the shadows, to be quiet, and hear what we're usually perhaps too busy to hear. This is also part of what happens when you come into a meditation hall or a retreat. You're quieting down enough to listen. And of course, we're working to end the pandemic and care for people, but in a bigger way, what would it be not to fight this turning, but to allow it, to welcome it? A kind of humility or not knowing what gifts all of this might bring. And that even loneliness can have its gifts. So last March, my daughter was with me at home from college on her spring break. And all of this happened, and she never got to go back. She ended up just leaving her dorm room where it was, and suddenly she was with me. This was a big surprise. It didn't seem like so great at the time. But it's turned out to be this wonderful, unexpected gift that I had sent her off into her life. And I got this extra special period of time with her. And just the other day, just a few days ago, I finally sent her back to college. And we both felt, we both recognized, this has been a very special time. And I also feel her absence. And I feel that loss. And I'm playing with, practicing with how, what is loss? What is loneliness? What is absence? What happens when I don't want it to be there? You know, sometimes there are ways to practice to bring in very positive states, and that can be very helpful. But sometimes I just welcome it and give it some care and some wonder. And I find that there's some gifts there too. And so now my home, because I'm not out as much, it's becoming its own kind of monastery. And I'm wondering, when I look back at this time, you know, trying to imagine, are there opportunities here that maybe I won't really see, just as when my daughter had to go back? I won't fully see until it's all done. And you know, we may also be feeling a mood shift. You know, it's springtime. Many people felt a lift with the election. There's a vaccine, not totally out there yet, but it's hopeful. And so to allow that too. You know, but there's still many challenges. This isn't our only social challenge. There are many coming up, here and coming up. You know, what, there's a lot of unknown. And my personal feeling is that some of the craziness we see and some of the polarization we see comes from even people who don't fully allow it into consciousness, which is probably most of us. There's a, some knowing in our bodies, like, we don't really know what's happening here. And that comes out in different ways. But I'm wondering what's possible, you know, in times of disturbance. I think we're in a time of disturbance. And I've been reading a book some of you might know that came out not so long ago called Braiding Sweetgrass. And it's by a writer, Robin Kimmerer. And she's a botanist, but also a member of the Potawatomi Nation. So she's trained both in Western scientific method, but also in Native understanding of the world and life. And there's a story she tells in there about harvesting sweet grass, which has many healing properties and a beautiful scent. And she tells about this story where there's a controversy in the Native community about the proper way to harvest sweetgrass. And some people say the proper way is to have the, find the clump and then very carefully just pinch at the base the grass. And then others say, no, the proper way is to take the base and pull up with the roots and everything, the whole clump. And they can't agree. And there's some decline in sweetgrass, so they want to understand what is the proper way to harvest sweetgrass. And they ask her, as a member of the community, but also in trained in scientific method, to help them determine what is the proper way. And so one of her graduate students takes this on, and she takes it to her research committee who is not impressed with this project at all. And someone, in fact, very dismissively says, well, everyone knows if you harvest a plant, it's going to decline. And she perseveres nevertheless. So over the course of 2 years, she painstakingly observes three different clumps of grass, one where they're pinching it very carefully, one where it's pulled up by the clumps, and one where it's just left alone. And she documents this day after day. And when it's done, it's quite clear, actually, that the two clumps that have been harvested, whether it was pinching or pulling, are both flourishing. But the one that was left alone is not doing well at all. And there's a theory that there's been a symbiotic relationship developing over some time where this careful harvesting actually stimulates the roots. So this disturbance stimulates the growth and gives room for more growth. Whereas the clump that's left alone, it doesn't have as much room to grow or as much stimulation. And there's also a practice with this. So first of all, they're very careful. They only take 50% at any time. And they're also, you know, rules, not too much disturbance, just enough. And then it's based on relationship and respect. So there's a practice that goes with this. Often I think we feel like we don't want disturbance. We want just stability. And we need some stability to grow. But sometimes disturbance helps us step fully into our life, into who we really are. In Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, Suzuki Roshi says, whatever we see is changing, losing its balance. The reason everything looks beautiful is because it is out of balance, but its background is always in perfect harmony. The reason everything looks beautiful is because it is out of balance, but its background is always perfect harmony. This is how everything exists in the realm of Buddha nature, losing its balance against a background of perfect balance. Please take a moment and just see how those words fit with you. What does it mean to be out of balance? What does it mean to be in a background of perfect balance? When can we experience one? When do we experience the other? Do we experience both at the same time? And he goes on and says, so if you see things without realizing the background of Buddha nature, everything appears to be in the form of suffering. But if you understand the background of existence, you realize that suffering itself is how we live and how we extend our life. So in Zen, sometimes, he says, we emphasize the imbalance or the disorder of life. So in meeting suffering, in meeting challenges, this is how we extend our life. And these disturbances is how we grow. I'm also thinking of the phrase, one continuous practice as one continuous mistake. Balance and balance, balance and balance, balance and balance. And in one Buddhist view, we're really lucky to be in this human body mind world with all of its suffering. Because in one cosmological view there, you may know these different realms. You know, they're the heavenly realms for the gods. It's really quite blissful out there. And then there's the human realm. They're the fighting gods. There's animals. There's hungry ghosts. There's hell realms. And none of them are permanent. But if you're in a place of too much suffering, and, you know, this can be a cosmological realm or it can be just our own minds, mind states. If you're in a realm with too much suffering, it's very hard to practice. When you're just concerned with getting your basic needs, finding some basic peace. But if you're in the God realms, the Deva realms, so it said, that's not so great either, because there's no motivation to practice. You can just kind of bliss out. Right? It's in actually this human realm where potentially we have just enough suffering for us to pay attention, for us to ask, who am I? What's going on here? How should I live? And these are the great questions. And wrestling with the suffering, meeting it, can bring a real maturity and depth and a very open heart. Just watching the recent election proceedings, I was struck somehow the commentators in the news mentioning the losses that President Biden has experienced in his life. You know, the recent loss of his son, and then before that, a loss in a car crash of his wife and infant child, daughter. And hearing him speak, I sense somehow, just as personally, a sense there's a heartfulness there that comes out of a life lived with these deep losses. And my guess is that through his Catholic faith, there's been a practice, a way to work with these. And potentially what comes out of that is an empathy. I hope so. So we all experience loss. This is one of the great teachings of the Buddha. All kinds of loss. Can't get around it, no way, no how. You know, the big losses of those we love, but sometimes you're just with somebody you don't want to be with, or sometimes you're not with somebody you really want to be with. He kind of laid it out and said, hey, this is part of the deal. And I hear this so much right now, like people who are alone really want to be with someone, human touch. And then people who are maybe with their spouse really want some space and some time alone. Yeah, so it's always greener. And so we're in this in-between time. There's a wonderful book I recommend if you're in any kind of transition, called Transitions, by someone named William Bridges, of all things. But he talks about, you know, we're at A, and A is sort of our life as we know it. It's maybe relatively stable. And then something happens, and that falls apart. And so that's really uncomfortable and vulnerable, maybe. And so we want to get to B as quick as we can, whatever B is going to be, the next stable place. And that's very natural. But he says, slow down. This place between A, when that's fallen away, but B hasn't really emerged yet. This is a really creative place. It's a place of vast possibility. And this is the place where many people find practice. Whatever was working before isn't working anymore. And there's an openness to ask these questions inside ourselves and with each other. So this odd time that we're in, this, I'm in a limbo or a bardo, sometimes what it feels like, and I kind of want it to be done, honestly. But then I have to ask, but wait, what is the opportunity here? And I can't make it be done any faster anyway. So what is the opportunity in this time? And you know, how do we come also to see this background of total harmony that Suzuki Roshi was telling us about in the midst of all of this? When I first showed up at Green Gulch, Jim was mentioning Green Gulch earlier. So I first showed up as a guest student just for a couple of weeks. It was in the middle of graduate school, but I got off for a couple of weeks at the end of the semester and went to Green Gulch. And so as a guest student, that was in 1994. And Tenshin Reb Anderson Roshi was leading a class. He was leading it on the Book of Serenity, which some of you may know. It's a classic collection of 100 koans. And this is the book. Now with the cover come off, my name written in here. And I wandered into a class he was teaching. And I remember it was on case 37. And I did not understand, but something really interesting was going on. And I think I asked a question and I realized I was way out of my depth, but I remember it. And so I ended up getting the book. I ended up leaving graduate school. I ended up saying, this is, something's going on here and I want to find out what it is. And it's been a long time since I've studied the book more formally, but now coming back to it, just even holding it in my hands, I feel again the sense of like being home. The sense of, oh yeah, there are vast treasures in this book, which I'm only beginning to understand. But I picked it up because I was thinking of a case that keeps coming around. You know, you're not just like done with a case. It keeps rolling around and working on you in different ways. And this is case 140. And it's Yangshan's mind and environment. Many of you know this. And Yangshan, the teacher, asked the monk. He says, I guess he's just arrived to the monastery. He says, where are you from? Reasonable question. And the monk says, from Yu province, from Davis, from New Orleans, from wherever. And Yangshan said, do you think of that place? The monk said, I always think of it. Yangshan said, the thinker is the mind, and the thought of is the environment. Therein are mountains, rivers, and landmass, buildings, towers, halls, and chambers, people, animals, and so forth. Reverse your thoughts to think of the thinking mind. Reverse your thoughts to think of the thinking mind. Are there so many things there? I guess the monk did that. He reversed his thought to think of the thinking mind. And then he said, maybe it took him a while, maybe he came back later, and he said, when I get here, I don't see any existence at all. When I get here, I don't see any existence at all. And Yangshan said, this is right for the stage of faith, but not yet right for the stage of person. Once again, you know, the monk comes to the monastery. Teacher says, where are you from? He says, from Yu province. Do you think of it? I always think of it. And he says, you know, the thinker is the mind, the thought of all this stuff, shopping malls and computers and cars and people and towns, all of that. But if you turn inward, if you turn that light inward, what's there? What do you see? He says, I don't see anything at all. And Yangshan says, basically, that's half. We got half of it. This is the right for the stage of the faith, but not yet right for the stage of a person, a true person. And the monk says, don't you have any other way of guidance? Can't you help me? That's it. Give me some more help here. And Yangshan said, to say I have anything or particular or not would not be accurate. Based on your insight, you get only one mystery. You get one mystery. You can take the seat and wear the robe. After that, see on your own. So he gets one of the mysteries. What's the other one? What's he talking about? And he somehow can't really tell him what it is. He said, go see yourself. What's the other mystery? So on one side, there's this background of total harmony, as Suzuki Roshi said. And this is a place you may come to in meditation. You know, the sense of maybe peacefulness or however it may be. Where you don't really, everything, life and all its complications might sometimes occasionally fade. And maybe you don't want to leave. Maybe that's a place of peace. It comes and goes. Maybe you want it back if you experience it and it goes away. Yeah, but what's this other side? What's the monk missing? You know, what about those mountains and rivers and towns and cars and shopping malls and ice cream shops and all that? You know, what about this everyday, ordinary life we go through when we're not sitting here in our Zen gathering or on a sesshin? I'm really happy that we chanted the harmony of difference and equality, because that's really what all of this is about. And in the group that Jim mentioned at the beginning, with Tenchin Roshi, this is what we've been studying, this harmony of difference and unity, these two sides, and how really this is central, especially in Soto Zen. They say light and dark oppose one another. You know, light, all the stuff, maybe the dark, that nothing's there. But they're not really different. You know, like the front and back foot in walking. It's one step. One step, one step. Front and back make one step. The light and darkness and the darkness and light. You know, so this is at the root of, like, say, the Heart Sutra. You know, form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. And emptiness isn't nothingness. It's just that there's nothing solid and separate to hold on to. Not fixed and separate and unchanging, but fluid and changing and interdependent. This is the background of harmony. And all this stuff comes up. And it's always changing and moving and growing and wow, including us. Right? And And the proposition here is, if we understand that, if we harmonize with that, we're more in line with how things are. And life is a lot easier. This isn't checking out and not caring, but it's also not grasping and trying to control. And remembering this is a big part of the path. So in the Eightfold Path, they talk about right view. Or in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, there's mindfulness of Dhammas, the fourth foundation. And part of that is remembering this view. And we keep coming back to it, right? So maybe first, sometimes I've heard like three levels of wisdom. You hear something, you take in the teachings, but then you think about them and look at them. Does this make sense? Da, da, da. This all happens to flow quite nicely with science for the most part, as far as I can tell. So you think about it. Does this make sense? But then you sit with it. Then you sit with it. And that's a different kind of knowing. Right? And we keep going around in these different ways. And then we have this beautiful practice container and tradition to support us in doing that and doing that together. Thinking of the phrase on the han. Don't know if you all have a han, the wooden board with the mallet that calls you to zazen. You know, and it goes bum 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 bum. I used to drop a ping pong ball on the deck outside of Tassajara Zendo to teach people how to do this, because it's the same mathematical ratio. But written on that in calligraphy, it says, great is the matter of life and death. Time passes swiftly. Opportunity is lost. Awake, awake, do not waste this life. That's what's calling you. You know, when we remember this harmony of difference and unity, this background of harmony in the midst of the imbalance, the ever-changingness, you know, then we realize we're part of this interbeing. Sometimes illustrated as Indra's net, this net with the jewels, and they're all reflecting all the other jewels. You know, and the great ecologist and Buddhist teacher Joanna Macy has said, you know, we're knowing that we're part of a vast net, that no matter like how much we screw up, we cannot fall out of this net. We are this net. And if we really realize that, what changes? Who are we and what is the world then? And one might say, out of this comes, that's where you the real fearlessness comes. True fearlessness, true peace, and I might say true love in the midst of all of this. So in this midst of ever not being in balance and at the same time being totally in balance, how do we live our life? So I will leave you with that as we all sit here in this practice place of this time. And explore the great matter together. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much, Meg. Mm-hmm. If anyone would like to raise a question or a comment at this time, please feel free. You can call on people that you see their hands, Meg, if you have the gallery view.
I don't have everyone on my screen, but I'll try to see what I can do. I have most people. I saw a hand. I see Larry. Yeah, why don't we do the little handy things down in the reaction? So, Larry?
Yes, well, I already am tremendously inspired to practice the way, but I'd like to think that if I wasn't and I was coming brand new to our virtual Zendo today and heard you speaking, I would be tremendously inspired. That was a beautiful delivery. It's some of these things I've heard before, but you put it in your own particular words, and it was wonderful and inspiring to hear. Thank you very much.
I feel very happy to hear that. Thank you for sharing. Sarah?
Thank you so much for a beautiful talk. I echo Larry's feelings. It was a beautiful context. I was just thinking, as you were speaking, it so resonated with what my experience has been through this last year. And it's sort of a milestone. We're coming up on a year. But I was just thinking about how isolated we have been, that isolation has made it's so hard to see that we're part of Indra's net.
Mm-hmm.
It's taken incredible faith to just sit with this disintegration that is happening in this darkness, mm-hmm. and know that it's that there will be a rebirth about it. And that's just what I've really struggled with, mm-hmm. with a faith that this suffering is creative.
Mm-hmm.
That something positive is coming because you don't see it.
Mm-hmm. And there's a not knowing, you know, there's a not knowing. And the bigger picture is so much bigger than I think our brains can comprehend really. But I hear what you're saying too about the, just feeling, you know, and we are very social beings. I was reading, there's a New York Times article about touch and how it's the underrated sense. And it's really hard on our systems to be isolated and not have touch. And so to not underestimate that difficulty for us. But also I've been practicing, and you know, this is through lots of different Buddhist texts, imagining beings, beneficent beings all about, but sometimes just feeling, bringing into meditation this sense of ancestors or enlightening beings or even the community of people all over the world practicing in that moment. You know, at any given moment, there's someone wishing you well because someone is having that practice of metta, of loving kindness without limit. And there can be a real gift to opening to receiving that. I find nature is also very helpful for me personally, or lying on the earth to viscerally feel this aliveness that we're part of a non-human world also. But thank you for sharing your thoughts. Yeah. Jim.
Yeah, thank you. When you were talking, I remembered a song. It's by Eliza Gillickson. And I can't remember the exact words, but it's something like, there's a new world being born, but the old one is still dying.
Mm.
Anyway, I'm sure I've got that quite not quite right, but the idea that you presented of transition and the instability of the transition, reminded me of that, mm-hmm. of that song. And I mean, this is, your talk, you know, made me think of just how, you know, our life situation is rarely stable. You know, there's always something new being born, and yet the old is still here too. You know, it's still here. And when we can't pull, you know, those apart, you know, and yeah, so, you know, the gift of practice is, as you say, I think, to just find some peace in the midst of this unstable, ever-changing, and often difficult situation, as you pointed out. So anyway, that's, I don't remember the name of the song either, but I'll tell you what, I'll send it to you.
Please do. It reminds me, thank you, Jim, what reminds me of a phrase I heard early on in practice that stayed with me, which is the groundless ground.
Mm-hmm.
So the ground that we stand on is a groundless ground. And therefore, we can really count on it. Thank you.
I'll just mention to the assembly that one of the things that I really appreciate about Meg is that when I've been practicing with her at different sessions and, I don't know, intensives or she often serves as Kokyo in Zendo, and I would always know when Meg was Kokyo. I'd usually know. You knew who the person was who was Kokyo. Usually they had, you know, a distinctive voice, of course. And there's also a point in the monastic day where at the end of the day, we chant the refuges. And we do that. Our sangha does that especially at the end of silent retreats, we'll chant the refuges in Pali. We'll sing the refuges in Pali. And it seemed like there was always somebody harmonizing with the, and I thought, I think it's Meg. I think it's Meg. But anyway, you know, that was kind of unusual when I first heard it. I thought, somebody's harmonizing. But I always appreciated it so much. The sound was so, because we don't sing, you know, in Zen so much, right? Very few opportunities to sing. And that was always so moving to me when there would be the harmony would come during the refuges. So thank you for that long ago memory.
Thank you, Jim. Beautiful. I see Oscar's hand up.
So I would like to, that inspires me to also thank you, Meg, because when we were meeting in the Zendo, I would sometimes have the opportunity to be Kokyo at the full moon ceremony. And I'm remembering now how generous you were in giving me advice.
Mm.
Naturally, you were the person I would ask on how to conduct that role. And I think of it, I always thought of it, and I look forward to thinking about it again when we sit again together. And I'd also like to thank you for explicating the old analogy in the harmony of the front and back foot replace light and dark replace each other like the front and back foot and walking. Beautiful image. But but you really amplified it for me tonight when you pointed mm-hmm. out, yes, but that's one step, one whole step.
Mm.
Two imbalances mm. come together to move the project forward, as it were. So that gives me a different perspective. And it leads me to ask, really, to repeat your question back.
mm-hmm.
Is it possible to see those two things at once, or do we pivot, as I've heard, from one to the other?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it also says, like, on, you know, when one side is illuminated, the other side is dark. And I've heard of pivoting, and at some Buddha level, you can see both at the same time. But so I don't feel totally qualified to speak on that. But I do know that in exploring this, my experience is that the day to day going through life softens. And that I think the exploring of both sides, remembering the other side in each side, somehow allows a kind of integration that appears of its own. You know, and of course the irony is that when in some kind of insight, it's no longer like, oh, that's my insight. Because I am Sue, because part of it is realizing that that softens too. It's just how things are.
Yeah. I'm not it, it is me. Thank you for that lovely answer, that very edifying answer, actually.
Thank you, Oscar. And I just want to say too, come back. Sure. Just want to mention, because you mentioned Kokyo and you mentioned it, Jim, also, that I so appreciate, you know, having gone out into the corporate world and trying to translate these practices in different ways, the incredible richness of this practice and how it's been refined over centuries. And these particular practices we learn, like ringing the bell or being Kokyo, singing the chants, or caring for the altar, or the way we work in the kitchen, that these are treasures, really. These are treasures. How do we care in this particular way? And there's a way that we can work with ourselves in that, create this field together. And it can be incredibly supportive. So I'm just feeling a lot of appreciation for this tradition and appreciation for the Sangha and your Sangha for helping keep it alive.